Chapter 42. A deserved stripes upon Miles Hendon's back. He saved from the gallows the boy who had captured the stray falcon, and also the woman who had stolen a remnant of cloth from a weaver, but he was too late to save the man who had been convicted of killing a deer in the royal forest. He showed favor to the justice who had pitied him when he was supposed to have stolen a pig, and he had the gratification of seeing him grow in the public esteem and become a great and honored man. As long as the king lived, he was fond of telling the story of his adventures, all through, from the hour that the sentinel cuffed him away from the palace gate till the final midnight, when he deftly mixed himself into a gang of hurrying workmen, and so slipped into the abbey and climbed up, and hid himself in the confessor's tomb, and then slept so long next day that he came within one of missing the coronation altogether. He said that the frequent rehearsing of the precious lesson kept him strong in his purpose to make its teachings yield benefits to his people, and so, whilst his life was spared, he should continue to tell the story, and thus keep its sorrowful spectacles fresh in his memory, and the springs of pity replenished in his heart. Miles Hendon and Tom Canty were favorites of the king, all through his brief reign, and his sincere mourners when he died. The good Earl of Kent had too much sense to abuse his peculiar privilege, but he exercised it twice after the instance we have seen of it, before he was called from this world, once at the accession of Queen Mary, and once at the accession of Queen Elizabeth. A descendant of his exercised it at the accession of James I. Before this one's son chose to use the privilege, near a quarter of a century had elapsed, and the privilege of the Kents had faded out of most people's memories. So, when the Kent of that day appeared before Charles I, and his court and sat down in the sovereign's presence to assert and perpetuate the right of his house, there was a fine stir indeed. But the matter was soon explained, and the right confirmed. The last Earl of the line fell in the wars of the Commonwealth fighting for the king, and the odd privilege ended with him. Tom Canty lived to be a very old man, a handsome, white-haired old fellow, of grave and benignant aspect. As long as he lasted, he was honored, and he was also reverenced, for his striking and peculiar costume kept the people reminded that in his time he had been royal. So, wherever he appeared, the crowd fell apart, making way for him, and whispering, one to another, "Doff thy hat, it is the king's ward." And so they saluted, and got his kindly smile in return, and they valued it too, for his was an honorable history. Yes, King Edward VI. Lived only a few years, poor boy, but he lived them worthily. More than once, when some great dignitary, some gilded vassal of the crown, made argument against his leniency, and urged that some law which he was bent upon amending was gentle enough for its purpose, and wrought no suffering or oppression which anyone need mightily mind, the young king turned the mournful eloquence of his great compassionate eyes upon him, and answered, "What dost thou know of suffering and oppression? I and my people know, but not thou." The reign of Edward VI was a singularly merciful one for those harsh times. Now that we are taking leave of him, let us try to keep this in our minds, to his credit. Footnotes and Twain's Notes. 1. For Mark Twain's notes, see below under the relevant chapter heading. 2. He refers to the order of baronets, or baronets, the barons' minors, as distinct from the parliamentary barons. Not, it need hardly be said, to the baronets of later creation. 3. The lords of Kinsale, descendants of De Courcy, still enjoy this curious privilege. 4. Hume. 5. Ibb. 6. Leigh Hunt's The Town, p. 4408, quotation from an early tourist. 7. Canting terms for various kinds of thieves, beggars and vagabonds, and their female companions. 8. From the English Rogue. London, 1665. 9. Hume's England. 10. See Dr. J. Hammond Trumbull's Blue Laws, True and False, p. 11. Note 1. Chapter 4. Christ's Hospital Costume. It is most reasonable to regard the dress as copied from the costume of the citizens of London of that period, when long blue coats were the common habit of apprentices and serving men, and yellow stockings were generally worn. The coat fits closely to the body, but has loose sleeves, and beneath is worn a sleeveless yellow undercoat. Around the waist is a red leathern girdle, a clerical band around the neck, and a small flat black cap, about the size of a saucer, completes the costume. Tim's Curiosities of London. Note 2, Chapter IV. It appears that Christ's Hospital was not originally founded as a school. Its object was to rescue children from the streets, to shelter, feed, clothe them. Tim's Curiosities of London. Note 3, Chapter 5. The Duke of Norfolk's condemnation commanded. The king was now approaching fast towards his end, and fearing lest Norfolk should escape him, he sent a message to the commons, by which he desired them to hasten the bill, on pretense that Norfolk enjoyed the dignity of Earl Marshal, and it was necessary to appoint another, who might officiate at the ensuing ceremony of installing his son Prince of Wales. Hume's History of England, Vol. E. Page 307. Note 4, Chapter 5. It was not till the end of this reign, Henry VIII, that any salads, carrots, turnips, or other edible roots were produced in England. The little of these vegetables that was used was formerly imported from Holland and Flanders. Queen Catherine, when she wanted a salad, was obliged to dispatch a messenger thither on purpose. Hume's History of England, Vol. E. Page 314. Note 5, Chapter 8. Attender of Norfolk. The House of Peers, without examining the prisoner, without trial or evidence, passed a bill of attender against him, and sent it down to the Commons. The obsequious Commons obeyed as the King's directions, and the King, having affixed the royal assent to the bill by commissioners, issued orders for the execution of Norfolk on the morning of January 29 the next day. Hume's History of England, Vol. E. p. 306. Note 6, Chapter 10. The Loving Cup. The Loving Cup, and the peculiar ceremonies observed in drinking from it, are older than English history. It is thought that both are Danish importations. As far back as knowledge goes, the loving cup has always been drunk at English banquets. Tradition explains the ceremonies in this way. In the rude ancient times it was deemed a wise precaution to have both hands of both drinkers employed, lest while the pledger pledged his love and fidelity to the pledgee take that opportunity to slip a dirk into him. Note 7, Chapter 11. The Duke of Norfolk's Narrow Escape. Had Henry VIII survived a few hours longer, his order for the Duke's execution would have been carried into effect. But news being carried to the Tower that the King himself had expired that night, the Lieutenant deferred obeying the warrant, and it was not thought advisable by the Council to begin a new reign by the death of the greatest nobleman in the kingdom, who had been condemned by a sentence so unjust and tyrannical. Hume's History of England, Vol. E. Page 307. Note 8, Chapter 14. The Whipping Boy. James 1 and Charles 2 had whipping boys, when they were little fellows, to take their punishment for them when they fell short in their lessons, so I have ventured to furnish my small prince with one, for my own purposes. Notes to Chapter XV. Character of Hartford. The young king discovered an extreme attachment to his uncle, who was, in the main, a man of moderation and probity. Hume's History of England, Vol. E. p. 324. But if he, the protector, gave offense by assuming too much state, he deserves great praise on account of the laws passed this session, by which the rigor of former statutes was much mitigated, and some security given to the freedom of the Constitution. All laws were repealed which extended the crime of treason beyond the statute of the 25th of Edward III. Semicolon, all laws enacted during the late reign extending the crime of felony, all the former laws against Lollardy or heresy, together with the statute of the six articles. None were to be accused for words, but within a month, after they were spoken. By these repeals several of the most rigorous laws that ever had passed in England were annulled, and some dawn, both of civil and religious liberty, began to appear to the people. A repeal also passed of that law, the destruction of all laws, by which the king's proclamation was made of equal force with a statute. Ibid. Vol. E. Page. 339. Boiling to death. In the reign of Henry VIII, poisoners were, by act of Parliament, condemned to be boiled to death. This act was repealed in the following reign. In Germany, even in the 17th century, this horrible punishment was inflicted on coiners and counterfeiters. Taylor, the water poet, describes an execution he witnessed in Hamburg in 1616. The judgment pronounced against a coiner of false money was that he should be boiled to death in oil, not thrown into the vessel at once, but with a pulley or rope to be hanged under the armpits, and then let down into the oil by degrees, first the feet, and next the legs, and so to boil his flesh from his bones alive. Dr. J. Hammond Trumbull's Blue Laws, True and False, p. 13. The famous stocking case. A woman and her daughter, 9 years old, were hanged in Huntingdon for selling their souls to the devil, and raising a storm, by pulling off their stockings. Dr. J. Hammond Trumbull's Blue Laws, True and False, p. 20. Note 10, Chapter 17. Enslaving. So young a king, and so ignorant a peasant were likely to make mistakes, and this is an instance in point. This peasant was suffering from this law by anticipation. The king was venting his indignation against a law which was not yet in existence, for this hideous statute was to have birth in this little king's own reign. However, we know, from the humanity of his character, that it could never have been suggested by him. Notes to Chapter 23. Death for Trifling Larcenies. When Connecticut and New Haven were framing their first codes, larceny above the value of 12 pence was a capital crime in England as it had been since the time of Henry I. Dr. J. Hammond Trumbull's Blue Laws, True and False, p. 17. The curious old book called The English Rogue makes the limit 13 pence halfpenny. Death being the portion of any who steal a thing above the value of 13 pence halfpenny. Notes to Chapter XXVII. From many descriptions of larceny the law expressly took away the benefit of clergy. To steal a horse, or a hawk, or woolen cloth from the weaver, was a hanging matter. So it was to kill a deer from the king's forest, or to export sheep from the kingdom. Dr. J. Hammond Trumbull's Blue Laws, True and False, page 113. William Prynne, a learned barrister, was sentenced long after Edward V.'s time, to lose both his ears in the pillory, to degradation from the bar, a fine of £3,000, and imprisonment for life. 3 years afterwards he gave new offense to Laud, by publishing a pamphlet against the hierarchy. He was again prosecuted, and was sentenced to lose what remained of his ears, to pay a fine of £5,000, to be branded on both his cheeks with the letters S50, for seditious libeller, and to remain in prison for life. The severity of this sentence was equaled by the savage rigor of its execution. Ibid. Page 12. Notes to Chapter XXXIII. Christ's Hospital, or Bluecoat School, the noblest institution in the world. The ground on which the Priory of the Grey Friars stood was conferred by Henry VIII. on the Corporation of London, who caused the institution thereof a home for poor boys and girls, subsequently, Edward VI. caused the old priory to be properly repaired, and founded within it that noble establishment called the Bluecoat School, or Christ's Hospital, for the education and maintenance of orphans, and the children of indigent persons. Edward would not let him, Bishop Ridley, depart till the letter was written to the Lord Mayor, and then charged him to deliver it himself, and signify his special request and commandment, that no time might be lost in proposing what was convenient, and apprising him of the proceedings. The work was zealously undertaken, Ridley himself engaging in it, and the result was the founding of Christ's Hospital for the Education of Poor Children.
The king endowed several other charities at the same time.
O God, said he, I yield thee most hearty thanks, that thou hast given me life thus long to finish this work to the glory of thy name. That innocent and most exemplary life was drawing rapidly to its close, and in a few days he rendered up his spirit to his Creator, praying God to defend the realm from papistry. J. Heinrich Jesse's Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.